The second case for oral argument this morning is Robert Dooley, appellant, versus Oakley Angesser, appellee. For the appellant, we have Sherry Sundemwald, Deputy Attorney General from Pierre, and Wendy Kloppner, Deputy State's Attorney. And for the appellee, we have Rena Hymans, an attorney from Sturgis. Ms. Sundemwald, I understand you'll be making the argument.
Okay.
Before we start, the front page of the Pierre paper this morning, they said they were doing siren testing between 10 and 10:30 this morning. And so if that does occur at a volume that becomes distracting for counsel, please feel free to stop. And we will not dock that from your time. So with that fair warning, Ms. Sundemwald, you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel, with me today is Wendy Kloppner, Deputy State's Attorney for Meade County, and she and I both worked on this brief. Respondent appeals from the decision, findings of fact, conclusions of law, and order issued by Judge Macy, granting habeas relief in a successive petition. The lower court granted a motion for certificate of probable cause, and from there the respondent filed a notice of appeal. This case raises serious concerns over the finality of a conviction and the appropriateness of a successive petition when an issue has already been raised and rejected by a first habeas court, and that claim that was rejected by the first habeas court is brought back again with the use of old witnesses with a new version of facts. I think it's important to talk about the facts a little bit. This case began on July 30th of 2000, so it's almost 8 years old. There was a crash on Interstate 90, and the victim, Dorothy Finley, was killed. She was found in the passenger seat of a Corvette. The petitioner was found outside the door of the Corvette.
The car was upside down, and she
yes.
was found actually on the ceiling above the passenger seat.
That's correct, Your Honor. There's no pictures of her in the Corvette, and there's no pictures of petitioner on the ditch. There's some discrepancy now as to where the petitioner was found, but obviously he was removed and brought to the hospital, and there were no pictures exactly of how Finley was in the Corvette other than she was in the passenger seat by all accounts other than one old witness with a new version of events who says now she wasn't in either seat.
Were the officers able to open the passenger door?
No, they were not. That was destroyed to the point it could not be opened, and they had to get the victim out of the driver's door. Trooper Ed Fox was in charge of the investigation. He took witnesses' statements that night on the interstate. Two of the witnesses he talked to were Eric Fowler and Cheryl Fowler-Delaney. I refer to her as Fowler in the brief. At that time, neither witness indicated that they could identify the driver. Fowler never gave a written statement. She said she was too shook up. She couldn't do it. Eric Eckholm did give a written statement. He does not identify that he saw or does not claim that he identifies the driver in his written statement. Trooper Ed Fox testified that he called those witnesses back. In fact, his investigative reports indicate that he called those witnesses back sometime after the night of the crash, and again, neither witness could identify the driver, according to his investigative reports.
Is that a dispute of fact now on appeal? It seems to
be. Yes, it is, Your Honor.
Whether he actually did call back.
That is a dispute of fact as to whether he called them back. Both Fowler and Eckholm now say that he did not call them back. They never heard from him.
Did Macy make a specific finding on that?
I believe he did. I believe his finding was that the trooper had not called them back. Obviously, the trooper's notes reflect something different, and while the trooper does not have independent recollection of that part of his investigation, he is adamant. His notes reflect that he called them back, and he is adamant that he would have asked each of them, can you identify the driver, and neither one of them could. The Corvette, the roof and windshield were intact. That's also in dispute. Eckholm now claims that there was no roof at one point said there was no roof on the Corvette, and he saw petitioner fly out of the passenger side of the Corvette. We know that's not true because there was a roof on that Corvette, and he couldn't have flown out of the roof of the Corvette. Finley died from substantial injuries on the right side of her head. She had a blood alcohol content of 0.102. Petitioner had serious injuries, but he was not in critical condition. His blood was drawn. At the time it was drawn, it was 0.081. This point gets lost. Extrapolated back, his blood alcohol was 0.125. There have been some claims that his blood alcohol content was 0.081, but actually, testimony at trial clarified that it was 0.125. The investigation revealed that...
Is that significant to this case at all?
Only in the sense that it's a fact that seems to not be accurately sometimes reported. The investigation showed that the Corvette was traveling at 112 miles per hour, which was roughly 164 feet per second, and that it rolled 1.5 times. There is also testimony in the criminal trial that the person sitting in the passenger seat would have sustained significant injuries. Obviously, it's the state's theory that Finley was sitting in the passenger seat, and she did sustain those significant injuries. And
did the damages to the right side of her face or body put any blood or other evidence on the right front, on the passenger side window or the frame of the car?
I think the evidence that criminal at the trial established that because the vehicle rolled, any bodily fluids identified in the Corvette would have limited value in terms of determining who was sitting where. Rex Reese testified at trial, and he testified that what the investigation needed to do is look at the relationship between the injuries to the occupants of the vehicle and the damage to the vehicle, and that would tell you more than bodily fluids. There was not a lot of bodily fluids, as I recall, found in the Corvette. There was some dispute over spoliation, which is obviously one of the issues that was addressed by this court on direct appeal, and whether that spoliation issue impacted on the bodily fluids found. Of course, the state's argument was that really bodily fluids had limited evidentiary value because of the fact the car had rolled, and there was testimony by Rex Reese to support that argument. There was a first habeas.
He made no opinion on...
No, the position. He just said there was testimony from the doctor that the person sitting in the passenger seat was going to probably have severe injuries. And, in fact, Finley had severe injuries and died. Petitioner certainly had injuries. He was brought to the hospital. The doctor's testimony was that he was not in critical condition. He had some serious injuries, but he was able to visit with or talk to the doctor and answer some questions, as I recall the record.
Were his injuries to the right side of his head?
He says that there were some. I seem to recall some discussion about some... I don't recall the injuries that petitioner had. I know that he claims he had injuries to the right side of his head in his second habeas, I believe. There was a first state habeas, and there was a number of issues raised, and what I think is critical for this court today is the fact that one of the issues raised was defense counsel was ineffective for failing to subpoena and call to the stand all potential defense witnesses. And the attorney that represented petitioner in that first habeas was Matthew Kinney. He testified it was a broad claim. Wrench, the trial counsel, testified at that first habeas, as did petitioner. They were the only two witnesses that testified in that first habeas.
What did Wrench say in relation to Ekholm as to whether or not Ekholm had testimony that put Engesser behind the wheel or in the passenger seat?
Pursuant to questioning by the state, Wrench was actually asked about Ekholm, and Wrench testified that he knew about Ekholm. It was a name he was aware of because the name was in discovery. The discovery materials indicated he didn't have anything relevant to say. Wrench also testified to two phone calls that he got from Ekholm when all of a sudden Ekholm seemed to have something different to say than what was in Trooper Fox's reports. So Wrench asked him, describe the driver for me. And Ekholm goes into a description of a driver with long flyaway hair. And Wrench was very concerned about that because the pictures he saw of Finley, she had short, dark hair. And Wrench believed his client's hair, he described it, I believe, as bleached blonde and kind of flyaway. He thought that Ekholm's description of the driver fit his client and not the victim, and so he was concerned about that. Ekholm calls Wrench back a second time.
Was this after the trial or before?
Well, that's an interesting question because it depends on which version of events you want to believe from Mr. Ekholm. In a private deposition he gave to petitioner's federal habeas counsel, he testified that he got a hold of Wrench before the trial. In his testimony in the second habeas, he testified that he called Wrench during trial. Wrench, to his credit, he tried the best of his recollection to call when exactly he got the phone calls from Ekholm. He thought they came sometime after this court issued his opinion after the direct appeal. Ekholm claimed that Wrench told him in the second phone call, don't worry about it, we don't need you, my client's a bad guy, he's a vegetable, and the law enforcement wanted to get him. Wrench obviously strenuously denied that he ever made those comments to Ekholm. At some point in time, Ekholm reads about the federal habeas that was brought, and petitioner's claims were denied by the federal court. Both Judge Schroyer and the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals found no constitutional violations. And so Ekholm calls federal habeas counsel and says, I saw something different, and a deposition is scheduled for Ekholm. This is in April of 2006, and Ekholm comes up with this elaborate statement of, all of a sudden, very detailed statement of what he saw in terms of the crash and who was driving. And he claims, while this vehicle is driving 112 miles an hour, going 164 feet per foot, he claims through tinted Corvette windows, he saw a woman frantically steering the Corvette who had bright red fingernail polish on and bracelets.
You know, the problem, you know, I understand, and I reading your brief, you know, you dispute a lot of what he's saying, and but how can we say the trial court was wrong on their credibility issue?
If the
normally we defer to the credibility, and the person, I mean, a lot of what you're talking about is not in court under oath. The trial court or the habeas court listens to him in court under oath, makes a determination that these two witnesses are credible. And I mean, I know you don't agree with that, but, and even if we don't agree with it, normally we don't substitute our judgment on credibility because we weren't there, didn't hear him testify, and all we have is a cold record.
I don't disagree with you there, Your Honor, and I'm not standing up here not realizing I have a heavy burden ahead of me. But this court has said time and again when factual findings are clearly erroneous, it can make its own factual determinations. And it's the state's argument that based upon this record, those factual findings by the habeas court are clearly erroneous. And there was some, these folks are simply not credible based upon the factual record. There's inconsistencies in their testimony. They were subject to strong impeachment challenges.
And that was all presented, however, to the trial court.
It was. But this court also critically can make its own determinations as to whether trial counsel was ineffective. Because this is an ineffective assistance of habeas claim, but this court has also said in Jackson that you have to go back to the main event, the trial. Was trial counsel ineffective? And here, Timothy Wrench had sound strategic reasons for why he did not further, if you will, investigate Ekholm, although there's an argument he certainly did because he talked to him twice. So he did interview him, even though the trial court found that Wrench was ineffective for never having interviewed Ekholm. All the witnesses testified that there was conversations between Wrench and Ekholm, and Wrench discounted his version of the events.
But I understand what you said was that Wrench said that he didn't interview him until after the trial. I mean, after the appeal.
That's Wrench's best recollection, but he can't recall.
But how do we use that? How do we use that if we're going to say that Wrench made a determination, made a strategic decision not to call him when he didn't talk to him until after the trial?
Well, there again, then you go back to Trooper Fox's report and what the report indicated. I think this court is at a very critical stage in terms of determining what defense obligations are when they're preparing for trial. If the court is going to take the position that Mr. Wrench was ineffective because he did not interview these two witnesses. Did he also have a burden to interview everyone else on that interstate to make sure they weren't going to change their testimony or to make sure that the troopers had not forgotten somebody? It was July 30th, 2000. I think it's fair to say the interstate was busy. It's right before the motorcycle rally. In State v. Lean, this court talked about defense counsel, how they prepare a case is somewhat based upon the criminal investigation that takes place. Mr. Wrench relied on Ekholm and Fowler's statements that they gave to Mr. Fox, or Trooper Fox, that said, we can't identify the driver. That's clearly in Trooper Fox's report. Neither one could interview or could identify the driver. What I think is also critical is Mr. Ekholm testified all of a sudden to these incredibly detailed statements about what he saw after he was mad at Meade County authorities for his own DUI arrest. He believed he got a raw deal, so he thought probably Petitioner was getting a bad rap. And it was only then that we find out he had an incredibly detailed statement about what he saw that night. And then you have to go to the credibility of what he claims he saw. How credible can that be? The habeas court did not take into consideration. They found both witnesses credible. You're right. It's my argument that that's simply not correct based upon this record, that the credibility of these witnesses is certainly in dispute. But before, I think it's also critical to keep in mind that the trial court went to the merits of this case before addressing either of the state's motions to dismiss. There was a motion to dismiss filed by the state under both 2127.3.2 and 2127.16.1. I think it's fair to say that the lower court gave neither one of those two motions much consideration. The second habeas was not filed until 5 years, 8 days after the judgment and conviction against Petitioner had been filed. There is a statutory presumption that the state is prejudiced when a petition is filed in an untimely manner. And this court has said that it does not look upon favorably untimely petitions. And when that statutory presumption is present, in Jenner v. Dooley, this court held that a petitioner must demonstrate by substantial, credible evidence that the state is not prejudiced in its ability to respond.
Does the fact there had been a previous habeas in state court and federal court affect that one way or the other?
I think it does, because this claim was brought up in the first habeas, which also goes to the res judicata issue under 16.1. Judge Bastian specifically found that Tim Wrench was not ineffective for failing to call Ekholm at the time of the trial. He had sound strategic decisions for not calling Ekholm. And that issue was squarely presented to Judge Bastian in that first habeas. Tim Wrench was asked about Eric Ekholm pursuant to the state. Why Ekholm was not called at that first habeas by petitioner's counsel is certainly a question.
But isn't that also our question on the second habeas, is whether the first habeas counsel was ineffective?
Well, I think there's an argument
by
that
not calling him.
Some of us may question
whether that was the proper ruling from our court, but that's what we've said. I mean, you get another shot at an ineffective assistance of counsel in the habeas.
You do get another shot at it. What I think there again, you have to look at the facts of this case. Tim Wrench said he told Kenny about Ekholm when Kenny came to pick up the files.
But didn't he also testify that he realized when those names came up at the habeas hearing that he probably should have followed up on him?
Well, that
testified to something to that effect.
He did testify to that. He testified that he was surprised. That testimony is troubling in light of this record. Tim Wrench said he warned him about Ekholm and said, you better watch out for him. And I think it's also important that this court recognize that Kenny said, I didn't know what they were going to say, and I know that you don't want to call somebody that's going to hurt your client. So whether it was a strategic decision on his part not to call him because he thought they'd hurt his client, I can't answer that. I cannot answer that. I do know that Tim Wrench was clear that he had talked to Kenny about Ekholm and warned him. Found Ekholm's testimony or his statements just were not credible and they could be hurtful to his client. Why Ekholm chose to ignore that, it's not clear. It's just not clear. It's troubling, but that all goes to the prejudice to the state with this late filing.
You know, if it had been 8 days earlier, you wouldn't have had that argument, though.
We wouldn't have had the presumption. We still would have had the prejudice. But we wouldn't have had the statutory presumption that the legislature has provided to us. And then you have the problem with a claim that was raised and rejected by Judge Bastian, which, in my mind, as I understand it, means that court found no constitutional violation, as did the federal courts, no constitutional violation here. And this court has said when it's newly discovered evidence, and this is, I guess it's newly discovered in the sense that these are witnesses that came up with a new version of events. They're old witnesses with new versions of events, but that's not sufficient for habeas.
Your time has expired. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to give 20 minutes.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. I'd like to jump right in. I feel like the facts have been discussed a lot. I'd like to direct your attention specifically to the 2004 transcript, February 20th, where Tim Wrench testifies on page 15, line 6.
Now, is that the first habeas in state court?
The first habeas.
Okay.
Essentially, he indicates very emphatically that specifically page 15, line 15, there was a period of time after the appeal was published. I did have a conversation with that guy, Eric Ekholm, who called me about this case. Question, what was his relationship to the case? Well, Eric Ekholm, his name was in the discovery. Question, and from his statements, it appeared that he had some exculpatory information. Mr. Wrench backs off. Answer, when Mr. Ekholm contacted me after the appellant's argument was publicized, yeah, he thought he had some information. Line 25, question, after reviewing the evidence with him, what was your view about the validity of his information? Answer, well, I guess I spoke to him on the phone and asked what it was he saw, and it was my view, after speaking to him, that it was not exculpatory information. This is again mentioned. Page 35, line 9, again, question on line 9. Now, there was a name that was listed in the state's discovery. Was that person interviewed at all? Answer, no, he was not interviewed. He had given a written statement about the events that had been provided through discovery. Question, and that information you found was not beneficial or relevant to the jury. Well, I didn't find out that information until maybe a year and a half, 2 years later, a long time after that.
And the point, I guess, is that our rules or our cases say that we have to evaluate the ineffectiveness at the main event based on what happened at that time, not based on hindsight. And what you're quoting from there suggests that Mr. Wrench was not ineffective at the time.
Well,
it's only with the benefit of hindsight that we're now suggesting that maybe these witnesses should have been interviewed farther.
And I guess I don't view it that way. The way I view it is at that point in time, the trial, the main event, Mr. Wrench knew that this gentleman had sworn out a statement where he specifically talks about seeing the vehicle, what path the vehicle took, where it was. He knew he was tied to the diagram from the State Highway Patrol that was the accident reconstruction, that this gentleman is tied to the parked vehicle that's in the diagram there. He knows that just based upon what he was given in discovery. He had two investigators working on the file. At no time did he personally call Mr. Ekholm, nor did he have either of his two investigators call Mr. Ekholm. And I would rely on Mr. Kinney's statement at the second habeas trial, when you're getting ready for a vehicular homicide and you don't know who is driving, and that's the whole case, you do not pass on one, now we know two witnesses, that were on the shoulder of the road with the best view of the accident there while the accident occurred. I believe that...
Is that too high a standard, as the state's suggesting, that every trial lawyer has to interview absolutely everybody that might whose name shows up on a report?
No, I don't think that requires that you interview everyone that shows up on a report. What I think is interesting is Eric Ekholm's statement. If you just read it, just read his statement, he clearly saw the vehicle go by him, the red Corvette, hit the white van, and see what occurred. I mean, you know he's standing on the side of the interstate. He says, I'm on the east side of the interstate. He tells you where he's going. I'm not saying that, you know, because since then we've had Mr. Schmidt come up. He's someone that the judge says, no, I'm not going to consider him. He came to light even after the second habeas trial.
This statement is what he gives to the trooper, right, at the time of the accident?
Yes.
Okay.
And this is, so Mr. Ekholm, this is what Tim Lynch knows throughout the entire timeline.
What was Mr. Wrench's theory of defense then?
It was my understanding that there was some evidence that was suppressed. He was basically trying to get into the habit of Dorothy Finley not allowing others to drive her vehicle. That was the direction he was headed. He was severely curtailed by the trial court judge in presenting that evidence. In addition, he had... they knew of a witness that was at the bar that maybe saw him leave or maybe didn't see him leave, but then by the time trial occurred, they couldn't locate this witness from the full throttle who they believed actually thought he saw the Corvette leaving with Dorothy driving the vehicle. Because it was hearsay through Dennis Finch, Mr. Engesser's civil counsel, it was not permitted at trial. And so I believe his theory was to show that Dorothy doesn't let other people drive the car, and everyone who saw the car earlier that day didn't put Oakley in the driver's seat. They put someone else there.
And Mr. Engesser has no memory, is that correct? Nobody disagrees with that?
Not that I'm aware of. He's never been able to indicate anything to me about knowing anything about what occurred.
But was there testimony from any witness that she had been driving earlier in the day in the first trial?
Actually, I believe that... there was testimony from a witness at the second habeas trial,
Charlotte Fowler. I'm talking about the trial itself. Was there something put before the jury to indicate that she had been seen driving the car earlier that day? You mentioned that as, that was his theory, but was there anything offered in evidence for the jury to hear?
I don't believe he had anything substantial. In fact, Mr. Wrench presented no witnesses and rested after the state rested.
So the defense presented, it was just cross-examination of the state's witnesses.
He put his case in through the cross-examination of the state's witnesses. And I do appreciate the court recognizing that many of the determinations are factual determinations that the state would like to attack at this point in time. And I appreciate the acknowledgement that it is clear and convincing. They have to demonstrate that Judge Macy's determinations were on a clear and convincing, clearly and convincingly in error. I recently was visiting with a colleague about the air in the courtroom that day. I was really amazed. Trooper Fox was called a second time in the second habeas trial. And when I got up to visit with him on cross-examination, it was just strange, the feeling in the room, because he conceded in a lot of ways that this investigation was not perfect. He conceded that, he had a lot of other individuals that were much far superior than him, that had vastly more knowledge and experience on scene, and it was 2 days after the collision that he found out that he was in charge of this scene. And by then, all the photographs are gone. I mean, how can you go back now and recreate the scene? to take the photographs of Ms. Finley in the car, or to take the photographs of where Mr. Engesser actually ended up laying, and to actually go back and place that Corvette into a locked, sealed place where the elements of time and South Dakota weather, especially in the winter, doesn't get to it. I know that hindsight cannot be, but in order to prove the fact that that there is likely a different result to have occurred, we have to view this totally in view of everything that we have.
So are you saying there isn't overwhelming evidence otherwise?
Excuse me, I don't understand.
There wasn't overwhelming evidence by the state presented at the first trial.
No, in fact, when I think Mr. Wrench said it in his first time, he was really surprised about the result. He felt that through a cross-examination, they would have gotten a not guilty verdict. You hear him testify in the first habeas that he feels that he committed error in the trial, not this specific error, but that without the spoliation instruction in correctly, and without him appropriately objecting to Trooper Fox's testimony and those things, Mr. Wrench, I don't think has ever felt that it was completely perfect in the first trial.
Of course, we don't require completely perfect.
No. You get the overwhelming sense from Mr. Wrench, Mr. Kinney, and Ms. Lammers as you follow this throughout the process, with the close decisions of each one of the courts and all of them talking that, geez, there's just something here. This just isn't right. It isn't correct. And you can't look at one thing that happened in the trial with one particular witness or one particular participant that gives you the answer. It's like a collection of humans, and at one point it might have been Trooper Fox not getting the photographs correctly, and at one point it might be Mr. Wrench not objecting correctly to Trooper Fox or not getting the right instruction in. But as you add up all of the different things, you know, Judge Eckerts was not exactly pleased throughout most of the trial. Anyway, that was my impression from the trial transcript. You add all of these things together, and what you have, in my opinion, is someone who is wrongly convicted.
But that's not the standard. The standard is incompetent representation by defense counsel. Not that I got a raw deal. So how do you translate this amalgamation you've just described into focusing on Mr. Wrench's lack of confidence?
He had one eyewitness on the side of the road. If he would have called and talked to him, he would have found out about the second, his girlfriend, that was right there standing next to him. And he did not interview either prior to trial. And now we know they place Ms. Finley in the driver's seat. Their evidence that was presented in the second habeas either places Mr. Engesser much further away from the vehicle, so it's not possible for him to be ejected from the driver's side door, or they place her actually driving either earlier in the day or at the time of the collision itself.
Let me ask you this: with the standard for a second habeas, or when you're challenging your habeas counsel, as opposed to challenging what happened in the trial and whether counsel was ineffective, is there a different standard that you would apply to the habeas challenge of ineffective assistance as opposed to the underlying trial? I mean, I don't know if I'm explaining this, but the question is, what obligation, I mean, does the habeas counsel have the same obligation to go out and investigate all the witnesses as maybe a trial counsel does?
You know, it's funny, Mr. Kinney, in the quote that I placed in the brief, alludes to that. And he indicates that it cannot always be done by a habeas attorney, that you cannot always rework an entire case. However, looking back on this particular case, he felt that once Ekholm was told to him by Wrench and then appeared in name again in the first habeas trial, and he let that pass,
that he was clearly deficient.
Okay. So it is a little bit different standard. But in this case, what you're saying is that he became aware of it. He wouldn't have necessarily had to go out and investigate it, but he was made aware of it, and therefore then he had.
Well, and in addition, I think once you go through the trial attorney's file and you see Erica Eckholm's statement, I mean, Mr. Kinney had the exact same information that Mr. Wrench had, because he was given Mr. Wrench's entire file. And to read through there and understand that the one person that, from the troopers, the statement the trooper took, was standing on the side of the road and not go, gee, you know, perhaps I should check this person out. Geez, this is the same person that Tim mentioned in that phone conversation that we had. Gosh, you know, maybe I should at least give him a call and see what he has to say.
Did Eckholm claim that the Trooper Fox lied in his statement of the report, that he could not, that he nor his girlfriend could identify the driver?
What Mr. Eckholm indicated was that everyone was in a hypersensitive state that evening, and he doesn't know if he told the trooper or didn't tell the trooper. He felt that it was clear that it was the woman driving the car, and he made an assumption that that's what would come out of it, and did not, you know, and I don't believe that the trooper asked him very many questions. Also, Charlotte Fowler Delaney, she also indicated the same thing, that she was visiting with the trooper. She thought the trooper would ask them what they needed to know, and she didn't know what she exactly volunteered or what she didn't volunteer. The only thing that Mr. Eckholm and Ms. Delaney were clear on was that Trooper Fox never called them back after that evening. That was the only contact they had, was in that hyper, you know, everyone flurry of the scene kind of deal. It's the only time they had contact with Trooper Fox.
What about the prejudice of the over 5 years?
It was 8 days. I understand that 8 days means a lot, but I think that it's important to know, you look at the complex history of this case, and my client was advised by at least 3 separate attorneys on what the proper procedure was to follow. He filed a motion for a new trial using the deposition taken by Heather Lammers with Judge Eckrich in August. On one of the documents in the 01-55 trial file, it indicates that it was received August 22, 2006 by the court. Nothing was done regarding that motion for retrial until October 13, 2006. At that point in time, all I can do is also make a supposition. It was with Judge Eckrich, and at that point in time, when Judge Eckrich rendered his order on October 13th, he filed the balance of the paperwork that he had received from Mr. Engesser between August 22nd through the time that he made his decision on October 13th. Mr. Engesser then turned around and filed his second habeas petition on October 30th. We're talking about 12 days' time. Seeing how he was in the South Dakota State Penitentiary in the Springfield Trustee Unit, I feel that he moved as quickly as possible once he knew that Judge Eckers was not going to look at this as new evidence or allow a retrial. He filed his second habeas petition, and he moved forward as quickly as he could, and he knew how. I would also note that during that time frame, he did request the assistance of counsel. He filed all the appropriate paperwork with the court that he couldn't afford to do so on his own and those types of things. And Judge Eckrich did not give him the benefit of counsel to try to sort this out on what he should be doing next in regards to post-conviction relief.
But isn't there some actual prejudice that the state suffers now by having this case tried years later?
I can't say that it's non-existent. You know, everyone, even Trooper Fox, he has a report. He thinks he knows what happened because he has a report sitting there in front of him, but he doesn't have any independent recollection of what's going on.
However, I don't know that Mr. Engesser is going to get the entire benefit of that either. There's still this person that was out there at the Full Throttle Saloon that apparently saw two people leaving. I don't know that we're ever going to find that individual. I don't know at this point as I stand here if Mr. Eckholm and Ms. Delaney. Mr. Eckholm has always remained in the local area there. Ms. Delaney is from Texas. I don't know if we're going to be able to locate either one of them by the time that this is over either. I think that it's a balance. And the view that I have is that Mr. Wrench is the one who started this course of action by not identifying these folks before trial. And I understand there may be prejudice to both parties, but that doesn't put us in any better position, having a gentleman that's likely been convicted of a crime he didn't commit.
So you want us to reverse Judge Bastian, who found that Wrench's trial tactics were not ineffective?
I think when you add this information that was never presented to Judge Bastian in any solid form, Eric Eckholm was mentioned, Ms. Fowler was never mentioned, that it adds a layer to what had already occurred that Judge Bastian knew about that rose the level to change or alter the course of the proceedings in the original trial.
So your answer is yes, based on new information.
Based on information that was available that Mr. Wrench should have found to begin with.
Okay. Thank you, Counselor.
Thank you.
Ms. Linda Mall, you have 10 minutes.
Thank you. Counsel. I think I need to start out with Trooper Fox's fatality report, which was filed in the habeas petition. It's marked Petitions Exhibit 4. In his report on the first page, he states, consensus among all witnesses to the accident, vehicle one traveling at an extreme high rate of speed, over 100 miles an hour, no one able to identify driver. And then you go on to page three or four of that same report. In the third paragraph, he states, Charlotte Delaney, who is now Fowler, spoke with on telephone, first interviewed on scene of accident. She reconfirmed that she did not see the accident. I also think it's important to point out that Fowler really isn't even today all that critical in the sense that she testified in the second habeas that she saw Finley driving her Corvette earlier that day. I don't think that that's a surprise to anyone, and I think I can't cite to the record right here, but I'm certain there was evidence that Finley was driving her Corvette earlier that day. Everyone knew that. It's also critical to point out that petitioner himself acknowledged and admitted that he drove Finley's Corvette earlier that day. In his first habeas, he admitted he drove it as well. The bottom line is, Wrench relied on...
Did she testify, refresh my memory, did she testify about where the body was or where the bodies were or how...
In the second habeas, she did.
Okay.
But critically... Even in the second habeas, she under cross-examination and fairly grueling cross-examination, she admitted she did not see who was driving because the car was in a spin.
Her testimony would only be relevant as to maybe what happened or what she saw after the accident.
Yes, and her testimony contradicts the testimony of many of the witnesses who testified at trial. There's discrepancy as to how far petitioner was found from the Corvette. The testimony at trial, and I think this court's direct opinion, talks about him being found 6 to 10 feet from the driver's door. Finley and Eckholm want to put it much further than that. Eckholm, I think it's in the deposition, estimated he was 100 feet from the Corvette. During his state habeas, he said 50 to 100 feet. Those kinds of discrepancies appear in Eckholm's testimony all the time. It's just a question of what version of events you want to believe from when he gave his statement the night of the crash to when he gave a deposition and when he testified at the habeas. There's substantial discrepancies consistently throughout his testimony, and you have to pick and choose which one of those you choose to want to believe. What is important is Wrench testified during the first hearing that he relied on Trooper Fox's report, that neither of these witnesses could identify the driver. It's Wrench never tried to claim that he called those folks back. And I want to make clear, I don't want to leave the court in any way thinking I'm trying to misrepresent to the court what Wrench testified to. He said he didn't call either of the witnesses because he relied on the report and he was looking for relevant people with relevant information. And they and their plan or their trial strategy was to create reasonable doubt as to whether petitioner was driving, and they thought they had done that. Important point is when the state rested during trial, Wrench and petitioner talked about what witnesses should be called, and petitioner agreed with Wrench not to call any additional witnesses. I think it also important that in the first habeas, petitioner was asked, well, what witnesses should have been called that weren't called? He came up with two names. Eckholm's name wasn't one of them. Kenny testified when the state brought up Eckholm's name in the first habeas, petitioner wrote a note to Kenny saying, what's this about? That name was certainly in discovery, but it still took another 2 years and I believe 8 months before that second habeas petition was filed. The deposition was taken in April of 2006. They still didn't file the second habeas petition until October 30th of 2006. Yes, it's only 8 days, but that 8 days gives that statutory presumption of prejudice to the state. Once that statutory presumption of prejudice comes into play, petitioner had to show by substantial credible evidence that the state was not prejudiced by that late filing. It's clear the state's prejudiced. We have Eckholm, who has all kinds of different versions of events. We have Trooper Fox, who cannot independently recall his interviews with those folks, but he was adamant that he would have asked them, could you identify the driver, and both of them said no. I think it's fair. He was honest and straightforward about saying, I have no independent recollection, but I know I asked him that question that night, and I called him back. And his notes reflect that he called him back. It's also important, Fowler said, you know, I don't remember everything. It's been a while ago. So she did. There's testimony in there where she acknowledges she doesn't totally trust her own memory. Another question, there was a question posed about why Wrench didn't interview Eckholm. He did interview him twice. Depending on which version of Eckholm's statement, we don't know exactly when he was interviewed. I suspect Wrench is correct. It was sometime after the trial. But up until that time, it was reasonable, according to Judge Bastian, for Wrench to rely on that trooper's report. In terms of a different result, again, Fowler doesn't add anything to this equation, and certainly Eckholm is subject to great impeachment material. It's clear defense counsel doesn't like this decision. Mr. Wrench testified he wasn't happy with the decision. Mr. Kinney testified he wasn't happy with the decision. But the fact that they don't like the decision does not mean that our statutory requirements for habeas should be just ignored. And that's what's happened here. The prejudice that resulted, the state was ignored by the habeas court. Petitioner came back with a claim that had already been adjudicated in the first habeas. He came back with an old claim, old witnesses, with a new version of facts. And based upon that new version of facts, the court granted habeas relief. There's no finality to convictions if that's what our habeas statutes allow. What are defense counsel in a position they have to do? When is an investigation good enough? This court has talked about investigation, what has to be done so that counsel isn't faced with an ineffective assistance of counsel claim down the road. They have to make reasonable investigation, and they have to make reasonable decisions to forego particular investigations based upon the facts presented. The facts presented led Mr. Wrench to believe that neither of these witnesses had any information that was relevant to who was driving. That should not be second-guessed at this point in time. In reference to Mr. Kinney and why he didn't call Eckholm, that's not clear. Mr. Kinney had no real answer for that. At least that's my understanding of his testimony. He acknowledged that Wrench had talked to him about Eckholm,
He wasn't sure that he had gotten the discovery. He thought he probably had. He wasn't sure he had read the discovery. He probably should have if he didn't. He wasn't sure if Ekholm's name was in the discovery. He was, quite frankly, not very committed to much of anything in reference to what he did in preparing for that habeas hearing. But the state asked about Ekholm at that first habeas hearing. And Wrench testified to why Ekholm was not somebody he pursued. And Judge Bastian found that it was not ineffective assistance of counsel. There's no constitutional deprivation of any rights. Many courts have found that. Judge Bastian found it.
Did Judge Bastian know what Ekholm would have testified to?
They discussed the fact that he had a different... Wrench's testimony was that he became aware that Mr. Ekholm had something different to say, and if I recall correctly, those were the words he used in the first habeas.
But Ekholm didn't testify.
Ekholm did not testify, and it's not clear why Kinney did not call him.
I'll ask you the same question. Is there a different standard for reviewing ineffective assistance of counsel on a habeas as opposed to a trial?
This court has said in Jackson and Hase it's the Strickland standard. Deficiency and prejudice. Was counsel's performance deficient? And if so, was petitioner prejudiced?
Is a habeas counsel required to go out and investigate all the witnesses?
I would assume that this court would expect habeas counsel to do a reasonable investigation. And I would assume that this court would say that there are strategic decisions that also come into play for habeas counsel. And I would assume that this court would find that habeas counsel also understands that they might not want to call somebody who might damage their client's case. And Mr. Kinney testified to that you don't want to put somebody on the stand that could be harmful to your case or to your client's case. And he had been warned by Mr. Wrench that Ekholm could be very harmful to this case because his description of the driver matched petitioner who had the long flowing hair. There was nobody in that Corvette that had bright red fingernail polish and bracelets on. So I don't know where that part of the description came in. By the way, the blonde hair in Ekholm's deposition testimony, he said the driver didn't have blonde hair, but by the time he got to habeas, the driver did have blonde hair, so that was just one of the many inconsistencies in Mr. Ekholm's testimony.
Your time has expired. Thank you.
Thank you.
Court will be in recess for 10 minutes.